Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today is Susan B. Anthony's 198th birthday. Her bicentennial will be in 2020, a year the antithesis of gender equality just might attempt a second term as president, if he has not already been disgraced and impeached. This Monday, February 19th, is so-called President's Day, in which lesser presidents are able to rub up against more reputable members of the White House Club. I am sure many will disagree with my choice as the best American president, William Henry Harrison. I base my opinion on the premise that his death barely a month after his inauguration made him incapable of causing any harm to the already troubled republic, though, of course, he had little opportunity of doing much good either. But his stubborn insistence of a 2-hour windy inauguration speech in a chilling rain that gave him a fatal pneumonia made him Prez number one. And we now also have America's worst president, who is currently on his golden throne in the White House, demanding a huge military parade like the Caesars, Joseph Stalin, and Adolf Hitler. Donald Trump is a bone in the throat of America. But enough of that. Yesterday was Oregon's 159th birthday, and also the birthday of Frederick Douglass. More about him after a dissection of Oregon's flirtation with the KKK by David A. Horowitz, professor of history emeritus at PSU. Tales of the North Coast Klan by David Horowitz. In 1926, Clatsop County was proud to host the statewide convention of the Ku Klux Klan of the realm of Oregon. Between 5 and 10,000 Oregonians gathered at a Klan celebration in Astoria, welcomed to the North Coast by the city's mayor, a friend of the secret order. Klansmen proudly marched in public procession through the streets of Astoria and Seaside, conducted naturalization ceremonies to induct an additional 150 members, and gathered for the dedication of new Klan headquarters in the county seat. The Ku Klux Klan even sponsored the runner-up candidate in that July's Miss Astoria pageant. Nationwide membership in the Ku Klux Klan peaked between 2 and 3 million in the mid-1920s. Oregon had the highest per capita Klan membership of any state in the Union. And Clatsop County followed Portland with the second highest Klan membership in the state. 1/4 of the adults in the county may have been enrolled in the Klan and its auxiliaries. Reestablished in 1915, the second Ku Klux Klan confined membership to native-born white Protestant males who took secret oaths of loyalty to the order. Klan literature boasted of the organization's dedication to pure womanhood, white supremacy, the Constitution, uncorrupted religion, freedom of speech, the common people, and public education. Klan polemics focused on the need to assimilate foreigners, non-Protestants, non-whites, and political radicals to the American way. When moral supervision proved ineffective, Klansmen frequently resorted to other methods. Although acts of outright terrorism and violence actually were rare in the 1920s, local claverns often employed economic boycotts, social ostracism, and political pressure to accomplish their aims, and of course in the American South, lynching. Klan organizers built on long-standing animosities toward Roman Catholics, in Oregon, to create a powerful movement in the early 1920s. The election of 1922 produced a Democratic governor elected with Klan support and a voters initiative which nearly abolished Oregon's private and parochial schools. The compulsory education measure, subsequently ruled unconstitutional by the United States Supreme Court, would have required children between the ages of 8 and 18 to attend public schools. One school, one flag, one language, Klan organizers proclaimed in the successful grassroots campaign. Klan influence in the state's legislature also produced a 1923 bill prohibiting ownership of land by aliens. Governor Walter Pierce, acknowledged as a fellow Klansman when he appeared at a secret meeting of the La Grande Clavern in 1922, gladly signed the land bill. Although the Ku Klux Klan played upon ethnic and cultural hostilities to build a powerful fraternal organization and political movement, there were very few Negroes in Oregon because Oregon banned black people, Klansmen genuinely appeared to be concerned with the moral tenor of life in the burgeoning 1920s. What concerned them in particular was the growing cosmopolitan nature of America's cities and towns and urban culture's increasing neglect of the moral values of the past. This great drama took on intense proportions in the two centers of Oregon's North Coast, Tillamook and Astoria. Tillamook County's Klan organization listed 195 members on its rolls in mid-1926. Many were substantial dairy farmers, retail merchants, and professional people from every population center between Nehalem and Hebo. The Tillamook Clavern engaged in the patronage and financial activities typical of a fraternal organization with substantial political priorities. It dutifully sold subscriptions for the Oregon Klan's Western American newspaper. It collected dues, money for Klan robes, and contributions for Klan charities, nearly $400 during March 1924. It also encouraged Tillamook County members to support the candidacy of a local American Legion commander for director of the state mental institution. This is the first political appointment that Tillamook has ever asked for, and we deserve this one, local Klan leaders exhorted their following. But Tillamook County faced growing social problems with the expansion of the regional economy in the 1920s. Oregon scholar William Toll has pointed to the disruptive effects of the period's logging boom. New opportunities attracted both transient contractors and a rough and migratory workforce that threatened the older families of the towns. Newspapers in Tillamook County reflected this discomfort with hysterical treatment of the dangers presented by the organizing attempts of the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, fondly known as Wobblies, a nationally organized labor union which espoused workers' control and an end to the wage system. Civic leaders in the Tillamook area helped to promote efforts to build a state coastal highway to connect Astoria to California. But as tourism increased in the area, so did social problems. Automobile traffic brought strangers driving lethal instruments at excessive speeds. Local traffic accidents were described in lurid detail by county newspapers. In one tragic incident, an intoxicated tourist auto killed a local physician. As historian Toll has suggested, the accident symbolized the clash between cherished community life and the consequences of modernization. The intense surveillance of private morality which the Klan provided may have been an understandable response to the dangers of a new social environment. No wonder that Klan records show that the expulsion of one individual in 1922 for habitual drunkenness, disorderly conduct, disloyalty to the Klan, and abusive language. Klan officials in Tillamook avoided ethnic issues and attacks on Catholics. But in Astoria and Clatsop County, KKK moral concerns merged more directly with the nativist movement so strong in Northwest culture. The Astoria Clavern attracted 900 members at its peak and a total of 2,000 between 1920 and 1926. Native-born hostility to Catholics and the Finnish community worked to give Klan candidates a sweep in the 1922 city elections. Klan support contributed to victories for the new mayor, four newly created city commission spots, and the county sheriff. But when the newly appointed city manager refused to cooperate with Klan patronage plans, the order pushed its political power by instigating a recall campaign through petition. This was going too far for most native-born Astorians sympathetic to Klan goals. The city manager was able to counter the Klan purge by linking it to outside interests. "We don't need Portland men to tell us how to run our business," he proclaimed in effective response to KKK harassment. Astoria's feisty city manager may have been the only man in town to publicly defy the Ku Klux Klan. A Catholic attorney was forced to end a speech at a 1922 meeting of the Astoria Law Enforcement League when he accused the Klan of divisiveness. "You can't say anything against the Ku Klux Klan from the rostrum," objected the pastor of the host Methodist church. The circulation manager of the evening newspaper then reinforced the minister's protest. "I am one of the wardens of the church. You know this church is anti-Catholic. I won't allow you to speak as you have been talking." The morning newspaper headlined, "Squabble at Purity Meet." Native-born Astorians were even more threatened by the city's large Finnish community. In the aftermath of World War I, Astoria veterans formed an American Legion post in 1919. Its motto was, "Alien Slackers Must Go," and it attempted to arrange the deportation of foreign men who had not served in the war, particularly Finns. At one point, the Legion tried to pressure one of the local canneries to fire a suspect Finnish worker, but the company refused. The veterans also attacked the editors of the Finnish language newspaper for failing to publish wartime ads for the Red Cross and the Liberty Bond campaign. Suspicion concerning the loyalty of the Finns created a perfect climax for the Klan's crusade to rid the region of foreign influence and preserve a culture familiar to native-born Americans. During the 1922 initiative drive to ban parochial schools, Astoria teachers formed a One Language, One People committee. Its goals reflected Klan desires to teach Americanism and stress the importance of speaking English. Newspaper reports indicate that Astoria school authorities gagged a Finnish boy for 3 months during classes to demonstrate the evils of speaking the foreign tongue. In another incident, a girl was expelled from school for speaking Finnish over the telephone. She had been speaking to her non-English-speaking mother after her father had been injured in an accident and sent to the hospital. Klan authorities connected the alien problem to their anxieties over moral stability in a changing culture. The pages of the Western American, the official state newspaper of the KKK, reflected this concern in pointed language. Published in Astoria by Lem Deaver for several months in 1922, before relocation in Portland, Western American editorials lectured subscribers on Klan moral and political duties. Immorality and degeneracy were increasing in America, Deaver warned 3 weeks after the 1922 elections. He argued that love of money and the natural depravity of the human mind were responsible. The church had lost its appeal and power, he complained. The people were to be found at the movies, mad for pleasure, power, ostentation, and class. The Klan's mission, an accompanying editorial preached, was to Americanize the alien hordes which infested the country. A Klan statement in the same issue summed up the findings of nativist sociology. "The greatest danger facing the American public republic today is the graduate replacement of our religious, social, and political foundations by those of alien origin," quote unquote. The Astoria Klan saw itself as a purity crusader in an increasingly secular society. Newspapers reported that a group of Klansmen marched into a meeting in the basement of the Astoria Methodist Church in May 1922 and left an $80 contribution. The money was to go to the building of a children's home in Corvallis, a project of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. Deaver and other Klan leaders saw Clatsop County as a lucrative den of corruption, criminality, and vice. Editor Deaver claimed that Astoria was the center of a mail-order divorce mill. On another occasion, he described a local political meeting dominated by bootleggers, cheapskates, shyster lawyers and preachers, gunfighters and crooks. The description may have been exaggerated, but as a port city, Astoria found it difficult to enforce liquor prohibition laws. The issue was crystallized when the Morning Astorian printed an open letter to the Clatsop County Sheriff from Pacific Clan No. 2 in June 1922. The unsigned letter warned that if the sheriff failed to clean up questionable resorts in the county, the Klan itself would take direct action. The ultimatum described ruthless, open, and repeated violations, quote-unquote, of the Prohibition Code. If the sheriff did not clean out the Whistle Inn near Flavelle, as well as several other joints in the county, another quote, the Klan promised to take prompt and drastic action. The letter even hinted that the Klan might clean out county offices not enforcing the law. The sheriff's response was to call for evidence of prohibition violations so he could prosecute. Meanwhile, he stated his office would not be run by other organizations. Nothing ever came of the Klan threat, but the letter was a public example of how the secret order sought its goals. By the end of 1923, however, when Deaver broke with the Oregon Klan, the organization had peaked both in Clatsop County and in most parts of the state. Only in Tillamook County, where the Klan functioned primarily as a fraternal order, did KKK activity carry on substantially into the later 1920s. The 1920s Ku Klux Klan, unlike its more violent, racially intolerant successors following World War II, was a fraternal order and political machine whose emphasis lay with moral character and the values associated with native-born Protestants. The Klan provided its adherents with a way to face cultural change in a spirit of ethnic and social solidarity. The narrowness of its focus is obvious, the potential for bigotry and intolerance enormous. Yet, as William Toll has suggested in his own scholarship, the 1920s Ku Klux Klan of the North Coast spoke to those frightened by the social and moral consequences of modernization. Klan crusades proved divisive and carried the potential for unwarranted hate against those who had their own moral codes and traditions. Nevertheless, North Coast Klansmen, like other Americans of the 1920s, found themselves trying to resolve the knotty contradictions between economic growth and its unsettling consequences. One can never condone bigotry and cultural intolerance, but those who follow history can certainly appreciate the dilemmas which plagued our predecessors, even if they did not resolve them in ways which stir reverence and pride. And that was Tales of the North Coast Klan by David A. Horowitz, who is a professor emeritus at Portland State University and one of my closest friends. And now, really hot off the press, How the Right Co-opts Frederick Douglass by David W. Blight. And he wrote this for the New York Times. 200 years ago, one of the most important Americans was born close to the Tuckahoe River on the eastern shore of Maryland. Frederick Bailey did not know the exact date of his birth, so he chose February 14th. 20 years later, when he escaped from slavery, he became Frederick Douglass, with two S's. By the time of his death in 1895, he had become one of the greatest orators and writers of the century. But in the same way that Abraham Lincoln has become everybody's grandfather, in the words of historian David Donald, the one American figure who could be adopted by every part of the political spectrum, Douglass is also appropriated broadly, especially by the American right. In his life of literary and public and political activism, Douglass was many things, and it is this set of apparent complexities and paradoxes that makes his story so attractive to biographers as well as to so many constituencies. His father was white, perhaps one of his owners, and his mother was Harriet Bailey, a black slave whom he barely knew. Douglass was both a radical thinker and a proponent of classic 19th century political liberalism. At different times, he hated and loved his country. He was a ferocious critic of the United States and its hypocrisies over race and slavery, but also, after emancipation, became a government official, a diplomat, and a voice of imperial expansion. He strongly believed in self-reliance, but demanded an interventionist government to free slaves, defeat the Confederacy, and protect Black citizens from terror and discrimination. He was a radical newspaper editor and writer, and also a pragmatist, a perspective he learned in the political crisis over slavery in the 1850s. Douglass was Jim Crowed on railroads, on steamboats, and in hotels more times than he could count, but loved the Declaration of Independence, the natural rights tradition, and especially the reinvented Constitution, the one rewritten in Washington during Reconstruction, not the one created in Philadelphia in 1789. He loved the Bill of Rights and never shied away from condemning those who wantonly violated in the service of white supremacy. He fought against mob violence, but believed in revolutionary violence for self-defense and the destruction of slavery. He truly believed women were equal and ought to have all fundamental rights, but sometimes he acted more like a patriarch in his marriage. He forged a livelihood with his voice and pen, but fundamentally was not a self-made man as he painted himself in a famous speech, an image through which modern conservatives and libertarians have adopted him as a proponent of their brand of individualism. On the surface, Douglass does appear to be self-made. He was the escaped slave who willed his own freedom, stole the master's language, and wrote masterpieces of anti-slavery literature. But without many people, especially women, his grandmother, two wives, a daughter, and countless abolitionist women who supported his career, as well as male mentors, both white and black, he would not have survived and become Douglass. In private, he easily admitted his reliance on friends and associates, and he believed in a theory of history rooted in the Old Testament, in the Exodus story, in collection liberation by God and by events. In Self-Made Man, a new book published by the Cato Institute, the lawyer Timothy Sandfer argues that Douglass's essential legacy lies in his advocacy of liberty, individualism, and private property and free enterprise. The radical abolitionist who risked all to use words and politics to free an entire people from slavery was, to Mr. Sandifer, only a radical for individualism, quote-unquote, and never concerned with, again a quote, the interests of the collective. To believe that, one has to ignore most of Douglass's career, especially his life as an abolitionist, his ferocious attacks on the poison of racism, and his brilliant analysis of how lynching emerged from the evils of white supremacy. Douglass believed that freedom was safe only within the state and under law. Douglass did preach self-reliance for his fellow blacks. He argued that the freed slaves should be given their rights, protected, and then let alone. But he never employed that let alone dictum without also demanding fair play and security against terror and discrimination. Conservatives have cherry-picked his words to advance their narrow visions of libertarianism. Douglass, the great American abolitionist, also happened to be a Republican in a century when that party stood for using government to free people. The right's effort to get right with Douglass is born of sincere beliefs, but also shows a movement's need for a famous black voice. Were he alive, which Donald Trump seems to believe he still is, Douglass would most likely laugh and warmly welcome the debate. At the unveiling ceremony for the statue of Douglass in the United States Capitol in 2013, congressional Republicans proudly wore large buttons that read, "Frederick Douglass was a Republican." Douglass's descendants who were there, as well as scholars like me with, shall we say, different training, smiled and endured. So, who's Douglass? Which Douglass? Dead, allegedly alive, as Trump thinks, or in his literary work? These are modern questions rife with meaning, but we cannot contain Douglass within such circumscribed limits. at the height of the national debate over slavery in 1857. He wrote, "Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did and it never will. Find out just what any people will quietly submit to, and you have found out the exact measure of injustice and wrong which will be imposed upon them." And then he added, "The limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those whom they oppress." Frederick Douglass's understanding of power could never confine him to advocacy of individualism alone. And that was How the Right Co-opts Frederick Douglass by David W. Blight, a professor of history at Yale, and he's the author of the forthcoming book, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. And the article I just read was from the New York Times. And now, from the Newport News Times, America, a Year-End Accounting, which was written by Irene Rasmussen, who is a resident of Newport, Oregon. It is a time for a serious review of what has happened to our country in the first year of the Trump presidency. Many voters, exasperated with gridlock in Washington, took a chance on Trump. His promises were big and bold and seemed to challenge establishment, quote unquote, assumptions. He supposedly gave voice to their anger. They talked themselves into giving him a chance. Was their faith merited? Not at all. From his first attack on Judge Curiel, to the pardon of Joe Arpaio, to his appointment to totally unqualified people to lifetime tenures as federal judges, to his misguided Muslim bans, Trump has attacked the independence and integrity of the judiciary, the rule of law, and the Constitution itself at every turn. Trump said he would appoint the best people, from Betsy DeVos to Ben Carson to Rick Perry to Scott Pruitt. He has appointed singularly unqualified people who are more dedicated to destroying their departments than to running them in the way they were intended, for the good of the people. Where Trump has not filled his administration with swamp monsters, he has left it an empty shell with key posts, especially in the State Department, unfilled. He has brought us to the nuclear brink with North Korea, and we don't have an ambassador to South Korea. From his initial characterization of Mexicans as rapists, to his attack on women, to his embrace of white supremacist neo-fascist demonstrators at Charlottesville, to his endorsement of Roy Moore in Alabama, he has consistently played to the ugliest, most divisive currents in American society. From his disrespect of the CIA in his first days, to his constant attacks on the integrity and competence of American intelligence services, to his current attacks on Mueller and his investigation of Russian election interference, he has severely undermined the credibility of vital American institutions, both at home and abroad. His regressive regulatory policy has done irreparable harm to the interests of ordinary Americans. He has gutted the agency that returned some $11 billion that banks fraudulently stole from Americans during the mortgage crisis of 2008. He has weakened rules on environmental quality and other consumer protections. He has turned America into an international laughingstock. A top German diplomat recently announced that Germany no longer considers America a superpower. Trump's outrageous retweeting of fascist, fake, anti-Muslim videos has made him persona non grata in the United Kingdom. The recent decision on Jerusalem made a mockery of 70 years of U.S. policy calling for peace with a two-state solution. His single major legislative achievement, and that's in a quote, was his tax plan. By most independent assessments, it is one of the worst pieces of legislation to ever be signed into law. The Trump GOP tax plan will kick 13 million low-income Americans off of health care. Within a few short years, when the temporary tax cuts for real people expire, but the corporate tax cuts really take hold, the top 1% will get 83% of the benefit. Meanwhile, 41 million Americans live in poverty, and the opioid epidemic rages on. Stock market gains are great for the 50% who own stock, but the rest still struggle with stagnant wage growth. The U.S. ranks 36th in the world in terms of access to clean food and water. Over 30% of Puerto Rican Americans are still without power months after the devastating hurricane destroyed their homes. The time for wishful thinking is over. Trump is a disaster. We have had a year to watch him in action. Progressives should stop being astonished at every new lie or outrageous tweet. We know who and what Trump is. He is a con man. At the same time, Trump supporters should be honest, too. There will be no pivot, no stability, no sudden hitherto undiscovered deal-making skill or magical bipartisan compromise. You backed the wrong horse. That's that. The only thing that can save America now is a blue wave in 2018. And that was by Irene Rasmussen, America, A Year Into Counting. And she wrote this for the Newport, Oregon News Times. And this has been Michael McCusker, and I will go out with the immortal words of the immortal Charlie Brown. It always looks darkest just before it gets totally black.